Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Very few contemporary philosophers are especially concerned with whether there is or could be a summum bonum. Of course, philosophers used to take it that developing an account of the highest good was crucial to work in ethics and political philosophy, and on some views, even to work in speculative or theoretical philosophy. That we needed to understand the highest good was a commonplace in ancient Greek philosophy, for example, and an interest in what might count as the highest good continued on through into 18th and 19th century European philosophy. In these more recent forays into thought about the highest good, that's 18th, 19th century more recent, European philosophers often associated developing an account of the highest good with advancing our efforts to understand the foundations of right action, sound practical thinking, and duty. In contemporary Anglophone philosophy, these topics are treated as matters of morality, what such philosophers tend to frame as concern over the right rather than the good. It's not clear that this way of framing and directing concern over the highest good fits older work. It's perfectly clear that it does not fit the older work that will most concern me, work by St. Thomas Aquinas. I will not investigate the ways in which Aquinas's work on the highest good intersects with his work on acting well, but the relationship between these two strands of his thought cannot take shape in the way that it does in modern thought. In this talk, I'm going to move toward Aquinas on the highest good from the side, using a philosophical puzzle to guide my exploration of the topic. The philosophical puzzle goes like this. Given that many prominent thinkers who have developed accounts of the nature and character of the highest good have argued that we cannot experience unimpeded enjoyment of the highest good in this life, in what sense can the highest good provide a target for us? Some such thinkers have gone so far as to argue that even if I am determined to orient my life to the highest good, I cannot attain this end by my own efforts. In what sense can I sensibly so much as seek the highest good, much less have confidence that I've set my sights on an appropriate object, if I cannot know what it will be like in advance, and the one thing I can know is that I will never attain it under my own steam? My aim in this essay will be both, or this talk, will be both to trace how these questions emerge for two modern philosophers and to offer a brief discussion of a way they arise for and may be addressed by Aquinas. I'm going to begin by having a look at John Stuart Mill and Immanuel Kant. Both are committed to the view that it is not possible for me to have unimpeded enjoyment of the highest good in this life, and neither thinks that I can attain the highest good all on my own. That is, both would appear to be operating in a context where my philosophical questions crowd in. For all that, each thinks that it is possible for me to be directed to the highest good, and each holds that it's possible for me to have some contact with it, even though I cannot experience the fullness of the good in question. For Mill, the task is to provide a world that allows for the greatest measure of a special sort of happiness for the greatest number of people. For Kant, the highest good is happiness in proportion to virtue. For Aquinas, of course, the highest good is God, and my best hope is that, by grace, I will be with God. Given this characterization of what I seek in seeking the highest good, as Aquinas understands it, the philosophical questions are stunningly more difficult to answer than when we're thinking with Aquinas than they are when we're thinking with Kant or Mill. After raising the questions in connection with Aquinas' work, I will draw from some aspects of his Christology in finding a sort of answer. But let's get modern instead of staying medieval. Philosophical interest in the highest good was still alive when John Stuart Mill published his much maligned Utilitarianism. Mill wrote, first quotation on your handout, "There are few circumstances among those which make up the present condition of human knowledge more unlike what might have been expected or more significant for the backward state in which speculation on the most important subjects still linger than the little progress which has been made in the decision of the controversy respecting the criterion of right and wrong. From the dawn of philosophy, the question concerning the summum bonum, or what is the same thing, concerning the foundation of morality, has been counted the main problem in speculative thought, has occupied the most gifted intellects, and divided them into sects and schools, carrying on a vigorous warfare against one another. And after more than 2,000 years, the same discussions continue. Philosophers are still ranged under the same contending banners, and neither thinkers nor mankind at large seem nearer to being unanimous on the subject than when the youth Socrates listened to, listened to the old Protagoras." Close quote. Okay. Famously, Mill held that the highest good is the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. And Mill took it that it was in our power to attain this end, although what Mill understood by happiness is far more interesting than what Jeremy Bentham or later Henry Sidgwick had in view. More than this, Mill argued that attaining the end governed and shaped his utilitarianism, that it demanded significant collective action, political reform, and cultural change. Complaining about Bentham, Mill wrote, also on your handout, this is a really important quote. I wish everybody who taught Mill would teach this quote first. "The problem with Bentham is that he has confounded the principle of utility with the principle of specific consequences." Mill is not a consequentialist. "And has habitually made up his estimation of the approbation or blame due to a particular kind of action from a calculation solely of the consequences to which that very action, if practiced generally, would itself lead." This is why he's bad. "He has largely exemplified and contributed very widely to diffuse a tone of thinking according to which any kind of action or habit which in its specific consequences cannot be proved to be necessarily or probably productive of unhappiness to the agent himself or to others is supposed to be fully justified. And any disapprobation or aversion entertained towards the individual by reason of it is set down from that time forward as prejudice and superstition. It is not considered, at least not habitually considered, whether the act or habit in question, though not in itself necessarily pernicious, may not form part of a character essentially pernicious, or at least essentially deficient in some quality entirely conducive to the greatest happiness." When a moralist thus overlooks the relation of an act to a certain state of mind as its cause, and its connection through that common cause with large classes and groups of actions apparently very little resembling itself, his estimation, even of the consequences of the very act itself, is rendered imperfect. For it may be affirmed, with few exceptions, that any act whatever has a tendency to fix and perpetuate the state of character of mind in which it has itself originated. And if that important element in the moral relations of the action be not taken into account by the moralist as a cause, neither probably will it be taken into account as a consequence. Okay. So you acquire traits of character by continuing to do the relevant sorts of acts over and over and over again, and this establishes a tendency toward such things, and that if you're not paying attention to that, you're not in a position to even understand the importance of the act. Okay. Anytime you've got that sort of a tendency, you no longer have a consequentialist, incidentally. I mean, that's a longer argument, but I'm willing to make it. Because I'm feeling uppity. Sorry. It's my fancy green coat. In short, carefully read, Mill's interest is neither in the outcomes of individual acts nor in the outcomes of a general adoption of one or another rule. Mill's understanding of happiness was instead rooted in concern over character and self-actualization as guided by character. Accordingly, his account of the highest good carries some of the depth of an account focused on eudaimonia and virtue. For this reason, it may be more accurate to couch Millian doctrine in terms of flourishing than it is to cast it in terms of happiness. He is, after all, the thinker who famously insisted that it was better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a perfectly content and happy swinish person. Now, it belongs to the tradition of thought about the highest good that even those thinkers who urge that we might attain the highest good through our own efforts and under our own steam, as does Mill, do not think that we can know in advance what it will be like for any individual or community of persons to attain the highest good. Mill shared this understanding. For Mill, as for many of his venerable predecessors, we are bound to aim for the highest good, even though we cannot know in detail what will be involved in sharing in the life of the community that manages to attain the highest good. We are bound to seek a thing that is neither part of individual experience nor even of collective human experience more generally. How are we to aim at something outside our experience? Mill's work can be read as providing a kind of via negativa in response to this question. In essays like On Liberty and the Subjection of Women, as well as in a wide range of other works, Mill set out to identify those aspects of the shared life of a human community that work against the flourishing of its members, and to develop strategies to at once remove the impediments and make such positive changes as might conduce to the greatest flourishing for the greatest number of community members, allowing all the while that not all members were likely to take advantage of the opportunities made possible by social, political, and cultural reform. It's possible that in urging that we try to understand the highest good in order to better understand the foundation of morality, Mill may have been drawing from work of my second modern philosopher, Immanuel Kant. Understanding the concept of the highest good in Kant is a complicated matter. Kant insists that happiness is an aspect of the highest good, where the desires or inclinations associated with happiness belong to what Kant calls self-love. But the happiness at stake in the highest good for Kant is happiness in proportion to virtue. And virtuous dispositions seem instead to carry the universality at issue in Kant's understanding of the moral law. So we're on the moral law side, not the self-love side. When I teach Kant, I just make two boxes on the board and usually draw a person in one of them and call that self-love and put in there everything that can make one person's practical orientation different from another's. So, your pet cat, your spouse, your best friend, the hideous things your father or grandfather did way back when, the aspirations your children might cherish, anything. Everything that sets you apart from other finite dependent rational beings is a source of action that belongs in the self-love box for Kant, as near as I can tell. But the happiness at stake in the highest good is happiness in proportion to virtue, and virtuous dispositions seem instead to carry the universality of interest. I already let you know that. It's not obvious how the dual aspect of the highest good can be brought into relation, much less welded together as a totality that is the supreme object of the will of a finite sensuous being. I'm going to rely on Stephen Engstrom's sort of magisterial interpretation to bring Kant into this exploration of thought about the highest good. According to Kant, finite sensuous beings are necessarily interested in their own happiness, where happiness is understood in terms of satisfaction of desires, inclinations, and needs. As the practical face of self-love, desires, inclinations, and needs are among those features of agency that serve to distinguish one sensuous rational being from every other such being. They are subjective and contingent, that is, in Anglophone Kant speak, conditional. As we all know, Kant takes it that the moral law, on the other hand, is objective, i.e., universal and unconditional. Whatever else one wants to say about happiness in proportion to virtue, then, one must at least say that this end will require that virtue or morality operate in such a way as to constrain pursuit of happiness. How's that supposed to happen? Engstrom puts the matter this way. Kant characterizes self-love as an ineradicable propensity of finite rational nature to claim personal happiness to be something good, an end for others as well as for oneself. Self-love is a natural propensity both to pursue one's own happiness and, in pursuing it, to claim it to be good. Close quote. In self-love's implicit claim that satisfying its desires, inclinations, and needs is good, self-love offers itself up as reasonable. Claiming a thing to be good is, for Kant, necessarily claiming it to be a thing reasonably desired, rationally pursued, a candidate, at least, for universal objective regard. Virtue, as Kant understands it, is a settled disposition, the strength to overcome inclinations that are contrary to morality. As Kant knows perfectly well, virtue, the disposition to constrain one's pursuits by the demands of the moral law, comes in degrees. The proportionality aspect of the highest good recognizes this point. It asks that everyone be only as happy as they are good, and that every virtuous person enjoy such happiness as is compatible with good character. This, then, is the nature of the highest good by Kant's lights. Notice that the highest good is, for Kant, as it was, in a way, for Mill, a totality. It is not in my power to realize this totality, even if my rational benevolence functions beautifully in my efforts to support the happiness of everyone around me to the extent that they merit happiness. As Kant argues, it's not even in the power of any arbitrarily large society of finite rational beings to attain the highest good. After all, nature need neither reward virtue nor bring ruin to the lives of the vicious. Nothing about the working of nature makes it impossible that a whole society of mostly virtuous beings will not be brought low by some catastrophe, like the Lisbon earthquake that so shook thinkers in Kant's day. Pardon the pun, but everybody was really upset about the Lisbon earthquake. In this sense, none of us knows what it would be like to inhabit a natural world where the best of us was spared the many kinds of unhappiness associated with infirmity, injury, loss, and the like. And none of us can make the world such that what will happen always and everywhere coincides with what is supposed to happen. Practical reason tracks laws governing what is supposed to happen. These are not the same as empirical laws governing what will happen. I actually think that appreciation of this point is what Kant meant when he said that Hume shook him out of his dogmatic slumber. The slumber consisted in recognizing that there could be a true claim about what's supposed to happen, even if what's supposed to happen almost never occurs. And that's this huge distinction between claims about what will happen, which are just false if they don't come true, and claims about what's supposed to happen, which might be true even if they never come true. So the laws governing what's supposed to be the case for Kant are utterly different from concerns that shepherd our thought about what's supposed to happen. This is, I think, the deep difference between theoretic speculative and practical philosophy for Kant. It's just this difference. Practical philosophy is on about what's supposed to happen. Theoretical or speculative philosophy is on about what we can reasonably expect. Okay. It's part of why every time theoretical reason goes to try to understand itself in Kant, it runs into a wall. Like it can't manage to get behind itself and understand its own basis. Whereas whenever practical philosophy goes forward, it goes forward with confidence. Because in practical philosophy, it's the cause of what it understands. So it's the very source of the thing that it seeks to understand. It's how practical and speculative or theoretical reason are different in Kant. Okay. It is at this point that Kant introduces two of his three practical postulates in the second critique. The practical postulates are wonderful. Contemporary Anglophone philosophers, there's three of them. Contemporary Anglophone philosophers love one of them, freedom. The postulate involving freedom, that I am free. Contemporary mainstream Anglophone philosophers are like, yeah. I'm free. The other two are that God exists and that the soul is immortal. Contemporary mainstream Anglophone philosophers would rather not pay a whole lot of attention to either of the other two. Kant, poor fool, thinks that you need all three to be in a position to do practical philosophy and understand practical reason. As is true for understanding Kant's account of the highest good, understanding Kant's claims about the practical postulates has been a point of considerable scholarly controversy. I will give a fairly simple reading of the postulates and their status. My aim is simply to show how Kant works to respond to the question how we are to see ourselves as oriented to the highest good, even though we can have no direct experience of its attainment. That is, I think, strictly impossible that finite, sensuous, rational beings could have any experience of the highest good in their mortal lives by Kant's light. Kant's moral agent is finite and dependent. By definition, such agents are not in a position to bend the cosmos to their wills, to enact universal laws, to set laws of nature, and so on. This is how come Harvard Kant can't be Kant. Can't be real Kant. Harvard Hume is great. To that extent, it cannot be in the power of the kinds of beings we are to attain the highest good under our own steam, individually or collectively. For Mill, attaining the highest good required fairly radical social, political, and cultural reform, the development of modes of shared social life that are no part of anyone's experience. While he seemed committed to the position that attainment of the highest good is out of reach in practice, nothing in the view suggests that it's out of reach in principle. The problem is much worse in Kant. For Kant, attainment of the highest good, of the highest good possible for finite, sensuous, rational beings, is out of reach in principle. In what sense, then, can it serve to orient our activities? Kant's response to this question, if I understand him, rests in his work on the practical postulates. As I said, there's three. I'm free, God exists, and the soul is immortal. As I also mentioned, most contemporary Anglophone scholars of Kant love the first and do their best to ignore the other two. I confess that I have yet to encounter an interpretation of the immortality postulate that I can understand. And there is, if anything, so much philosophical support for and work on the postulate that each of us is free that I cannot think what to add to that. It's like, boy, have people just written their socks off around that one. What will concern me instead is the postulate about God. I love this postulate. A practical postulate for Kant is a framing assumption necessary to making the fundamental operations of practical reason, as he understands these, intelligible. If it makes sense to understand finite, sensuous, rational beings as addressees of imperatives, as beings that can know the better and choose the worse, then such beings must be operating under the implicit assumption that they have the power to choose to do as they ought to do, or to choose otherwise. To that extent, the whole account of finite, sensuous, rational beings as addressees of imperatives relies upon the supposition that such beings are free, a thing that cannot be proved. Their freedom is no part of their experience of themselves. It is rather a background condition on the efficacy of practical reason. And that practical reasoning can be efficacious is presupposed in any exercise of practical reason. I mean, look, I can deliberate about what to do. I can't deliberate about whether to do it under my own steam. That's the kind of point that's an issue here. So how does God get into this picture? Kant thinks that he has established that a totality consisting in happiness in proportion to virtue is the supreme object of practical reason, what each of us strives to realize, even though none of us can produce a world in which happiness is in fact proportioned to virtue. Since my practical reasoning in any instance is constrained by what it is in my power to accomplish, by Kant's lights, the thing that my own reason demands as its ultimate end lies entirely beyond my power. We cannot make sense of my practical judgment and my efforts to cultivate virtue without seeing these aspects of my life as aimed at my participation in the highest good. I cannot direct myself to any good that is entirely unrealizable. To the extent that I operate to allow morality to constrain my pursuit of happiness, I implicitly treat happiness in proportion to virtue as realizable. Is that clear? And I actually think this is beautiful, but, you know. God's agency is the agency that could realize the highest good, a thing that is in principle out of reach for the very creatures necessarily directed to its realization. The practical postulate that God exists secures the possibility of the highest good. Is that clear? Like, I can't make it the case, it's out of my power to make it the case that people are only as happy as they are good. That that's ever true. The only agent that could do that is God. So if the highest good is possible, then I have to implicitly assume the possibility of a God that could in fact dish out happiness in proportion to virtue. Kant's God is in many... I know I should be reading The Religion with you to really get into this stuff, but you can get there with The Metaphysics of Morals and The Second Critique just fine. Kant's God is in many respects peculiar. Kant's is a strangely thin God, knowable only in the sense that its existence secures the intelligibility of various aspects of practical philosophy. It's not just that Kant aspires to a religion within the limits of reason as Kant understands these. It is that Kant is content with a God that operates as a necessary but strictly incomprehensible guarantor of the intelligibility of the highest good. This is a God spun from philosophy, a God that is at least at some remove from the operation of practical reason. Even if this God created finite, sensuous, rational beings, it is not a God that directly legislates the moral law by which these beings steer their lives, the law which constrains their pursuit of happiness and which sets the terms for the best that any and all of them can hope to see. Right? It's like so autonomy is so crucial to Kant. He argues extensively that whatever's going on with the moral law, it can't be that it's legislated by God. It has to be legislated by my own most pure practical reason. It's not obvious whether or how anyone would worship this God. This God is, in theory, a source of providence, but it's not clear in what ways this God might be actually providential, or whether and how it might concern itself with the very beings who unknowingly rely on it in cultivating the strength needed to hold fast to the moral law in action. These are all peculiarities of the way that Kant is addressing the sort of puzzle I've been circling around. Things are otherwise in Aquinas. The highest good for Aquinas is, you know, God. Fully actual, perfectly simple, supremely good. And it'd be God. Aquinas argues that the highest good for human creatures is the happiness of beatitude. In this life, we can know a form of flourishing consonant with human nature, but by God's grace, we may enjoy a more perfect happiness. We can enjoy a kind of union with God in a resurrected life. That's the promise, or the possibility. It's not a promise in the way that, like, you know, I promised to show up and give this talk, right? It's more like, by God's grace, I might be granted this. It remains gratuitous. Simon Gain puts the point this way. The happiness or beatitude of the human creature plays a central role in the structure of Aquinas' theology. Together with natural flourishing of this life, that is proportioned to human nature itself, Aquinas identifies a more perfect final end for human beings, which lies above their nature and in the next life, a beatitude whereby they share in a higher way in the very beatitude of God, the Holy Trinity, participating in the divine nature. While their perfect or complete beatitude will extend to the human animal in its entirety, body as well as soul, sense as well as intellect, the very core of this beatitude formally consists in a vision graciously granted to the human intellect. It is this glorious act of intellect in which beatitude formally consists, because it is only in this graced act that the supreme good is somehow attained, such that even the separated soul may pass without its body from the life on earth to the life of heaven prior to the resurrection. Close quote. He's sailing through a bunch of topics that are actually incredibly complicated if you're dealing in a more serious way with Aquinas. So treat it as a Cliff Notes-y kind of summary. Like, these are the big points. Right? These are the highlights. These are not the arguments for any of them. Okay? Obviously, we're back to me, we cannot attain beatific vision through our own efforts alone. Okay? Even on my best day. I'm not really lined up for union with God and participating in the divine nature, you know, as a sharer. Obviously, our most perfect supernatural beatitude is no part of ordinary human experience. It is hard even to imagine what it will mean for a human intellect to share in God's beatitude. I find it so. In Mill, the trouble with knowing the happiness we seek was largely a matter of practice. No one has got there yet, so on solidly empiricist grounds, none of us can know what it will be like. I mean, this may be strongest in on the subjection of women, where he doesn't think, where he thinks that women have been so put down for so long that, like, we don't even know what women's nature is. Mm. Like, we don't even know what the nature of the female human being is, because we've so distorted and trampled on them. So, I mean, to know what it would be like to live in a fully egalitarian society, I mean, who knows? But he still aspires to it. In Kant, there was the more profound principled problem. In willing the highest good, I will a thing entirely beyond my power to bring about. Not even like eight of us in a really serious scholarly Kant reading group are going to get there. To so much as operate as if the highest good is attainable, and the picture of the highest good flows directly from abstract reflection on pure practical reason, operative in the finite sensuous rational being, the moral agent implicitly assumes such God as is needed to be the agent that might actualize the highest good. The highest good necessarily orients my reach and eludes my grasp on Kant's account. But the needs of my orientation to the highest good are bound up with practical reason as such on this view. So I do not need to comprehend the God of the practical postulate in order to be directed to the good that this postulated God is introduced to make possible. By Aquinas' lights, I need a source outside my own reason to seek in humility, reverence, obedience, and wonder the final end that promises to satisfy the whole restless longing of my heart by granting me a vision of God. What kind of confidence can I have that such a thing is possible for me? Is there any sort of basis for my hope? I will follow gain in urging that Aquinas' account of Christ's immediate knowledge of God holds out the possibility of perfect supernatural beatitude to believers. Aquinas' understanding of the Incarnation gives the basis for a theological response to the questions about the sense in which I can orient myself to a final end that I cannot fully comprehend. I will follow Guy Mancini in tracing Aquinas' account of the earthly Christ's knowledge of God. Mancini, like Gain, is indebted to Bernard Longergan's work on the question of how the earthly Christ communicated something of his divine knowledge to human beings. I take it that Lonergan went a step beyond Aquinas in exploring this question. That's a way of saying I'm not one of his crew. He went further than Aquinas. There have been a number of attempts to urge that Aquinas provides a metaphysical explanation for faith in the teachings of Christ. As Mancini argues, this does not seem to be the tack Aquinas takes. Rather, Aquinas proceeds by understanding what the Incarnation is supposed to accomplish and tracing what has to be true of the incarnate Word if the Word made flesh is to accomplish the teaching and salvific task that could not be accomplished unless God came among us as a human being. In effect, in order for the human Christ to know his identity and his mission and to teach us in the way that was necessary if we were to have any hope of salvation and of one day sharing in God's knowledge of God, the human Christ had to have immediate knowledge of God. As Gain put it, the Savior needed to see the Father. And of course, in seeing the Father, needed to have divine understanding of the Trinity, and that the three persons are consubstantial. This was crucial if Christ was knowingly to be who he was and do what he did. interweaving commentary on the structure of Aquinas' discussion of the incarnate word in the Summa Theologiae with Aquinas' commentaries on scripture, Mancini summarizes Aquinas' teaching this way. What we know in faith, we know because of the preaching of Christ. From that content, we may conclude to what he knows as a man in his human soul. But since that content either asserts or implies the identity of Christ as the Word of the Father, we conclude at last both to this identity and to the divine knowledge of Christ as God. And in this order of things, the theorem of the man Christ's immediate knowledge of God becomes evident as what it is, an account, part of an account, of the datum of faith, precisely as the datum is handed to our faith from the human preaching of the human Christ. Thus, St. Thomas knows Christ's beatific knowledge because it is required to explain the fact, recorded in the Gospels and grasped by faith, of what our Lord knows and tells us. St. Thomas knows the beatific knowledge of Christ as the theological glue of an argument ex conventienta, and in the absence of a metaphysical deduction that serves as a bridge in the disciplinary order between consideration of the soul of Christ and consideration of the properties of that soul. Close quote. What we know by faith, the teachings of Scripture, Jesus knew directly and immediately. And so, among other things, in Christ we have an example of a human being who knows God in the way that God knows God. That it was necessary that such knowledge be communicated, however imperfectly, by a human being among human beings, can be seen as one of the reasons that the humanity of Christ was crucial to his mission. And it is because of the incarnation that we can have a sense that it might be possible for us to attain our final end. Mancini puts the point this way, quote, knowing God in God's way, the end state of our knowledge as Christians, a state St. Thomas imputes to Christ in his earthly life, is what is called the beatific vision. By this is meant an immediate knowledge of God as he is in himself, the finite mind sharing in the infinite act of understanding, the infinite intelligibility that God is. But that such a thing could happen is not known except to faith, and the idea of it, therefore, just as much a sort of limit or analogical idea, indeed an anagogical idea, as it is the idea we have of God or of the Trinity or of the Incarnation. All St. Thomas really has to say about it is this, that if no created similitude of God could really give us knowledge of him as he knows himself to be, then this knowledge does not happen by way of a created similitude. Rather, the divine being itself is what is immediately present to the created mind. Okay. I began by tracing thought about the highest good in the work of two modern philosophers, John Stuart Mill and Immanuel Kant. Mill took himself to be working in a tradition of thought that stretched back to Plato. It is unlikely that Kant had any less exalted an understanding of his treatment of the topic. I mean, Kant never hides a light under a bushel. Both took on the thought that in directing my efforts to my final end, to the highest good, I aim at something of which I have no experience. Mill had only a sense of what might be required for human flourishing to go on, got largely through identifying what he took to be impediments to flourishing. In his own odd way, Kant introduced a kind of datum of rational faith to help us understand the possibility of the totality that is our ultimate aim. I thought with the two of them, in order to explore some of the possibilities of a strictly philosophical attempt to understand the highest good. What we get from even the small foray into Aquinas' thought about the highest good, the theological case, is, I think, clearer. The highest good is God, God is at once creator and legislator, and an economic account of how we come from God and by grace are headed back to God through the salvific identity and mission of Christ provides a structured account of our lot, the darkness in which we often find ourselves, and the kind of light we can hope to enjoy because of Christ. I have offered no more than a sketch of what Aquinas gives us. I hope that it's enough of a sketch to provide some sense of the account. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.